Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Ted Tufas is joining us to discuss the ins and outs of the Mito Cocktail Part 2. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature in the bottom menu bar of your screen. It's really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not in the chat. You can feel free to use the chat to talk with each other and ask questions, but the Q&A feature helps me to stay organized when we start asking questions. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible today. Today, Dr. Ted Tufas will expound on his December expert series, where he explored how our bodies digest and absorb nutrients from food. He will dive deep into how different components of the Mito cocktail work after they are absorbed into our body. If you missed part one, don't worry, it's recorded and you can go back and review this session on our expert series page. But even if you missed part one, please stick around today because you will still find new areas of insight, whether you saw the first session or not. As always, this session today is being recorded so you can view and share with others in our Mito community. Dr. Ted Tufas is a clinical pharmacist and pharmacist in charge of the Acton Pharmacy Compounding Lab. He has a Bachelor's of Science from the Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Biochemistry and Genetics and a Doctorate of Pharmacy from MCPHS University. He has a passion for learning and imparting information to patients and colleagues. Ted has received training in compounding medications, hazardous drug compounding, veterinary compounding, and quality assurance. Working closely with physicians and patients, he develops formulations that will be best suited for his patient needs. Under his supervision, Acton Pharmacy's compounding lab has gained accreditation with the Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board and is the first in New England, third in the US, to have a certificate of distinction in hazardous medication compounding. He has been at Acton Pharmacy since 2005 and strives for continuous improvement in the quality of healthcare for our patients. Thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Tufas. We are really, really excited to learn more, and you're a great educator. So we really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie. Let me just share my screen real quick, make sure everybody can see it. Okay, is that good, Stephanie?
That's good.
Perfect. Why is this not pulling up? Give me a second, sorry. There we go. Okay. Let's go move. So I have to reorganize the screen a little bit. So I wasn't expecting it to do a little bit different than what we saw a second ago. Well, thank you for having me again, Stephanie. Thank you for the wonderful introduction. I hope you guys who did get a chance to watch part one enjoyed it. I'll try and do kind of similar things with part two. So we'll dive right in so we can leave a lot of time for questions as we can. In part one, we went over a lot of information about how the body digests and absorbs food. And in part two, we're going to look at specific vitamins and cofactors that are associated with the Mito cocktail. A couple of additional concepts to understand when we're talking about these vitamins and cofactors are reduction in oxidation or redox reactions, because we hear a lot about that with oxidation or oxidative damage in the cells, and their affinity or lack thereof to water. Both play a role into how the molecules are absorbed by the body. So oxidation reduction, you're looking at loss and gain of electrons. I actually had a teacher in AP Bio in high school who gave me the moniker of, well, not the moniker, I mean the shorthand abbreviation, whatever you want to call it. Leo the lion goes GER. So loss of electrons, oxidation, gain of electrons, reduction. So LEOGER. I've never forgotten it since high school. So it's stuck with me. So wherever you are, Mr. Davis, thank you. The simplest way to look at redox reactions, like I said, is a loss or gain of electron or a hydrogen atom. That's another way of looking at it. It's a proton change. Hydrogen atoms, when they're ionized, are basically just a proton with a neutron. That's what they're called. They have a positive charge. A lot of reactions in the body are former redox reactions where the body's enzymes manipulate molecules to break them down or add groups or elements to a base molecule. redox reactions can happen spontaneously when a molecule is exposed to air or oxygen, or to an acid or base, which an acid, you know, an acid is hydrogen, or has a lot of hydrogen released in the solution. These reactions can alter the charge of a molecule. As we said in part one, charged molecules tend to attract a sphere of hydration, or a lot of water molecules will surround them, making them harder to absorb because they become larger in size. One of the things to remember about the pH scale or the measurement of acidity is that the more acidic something is, or in other words, the lower the pH number, so a pH of 2, which is what the stomach acid is, the more free hydrogen atoms there are available, which is what causes the acidity of a chemical solution. And when you're talking, let's say, you know, we say proton or hydrogen interchangeably, think of it also in the stomach. When you say a proton pump inhibitor, like omeprazole, for example, it inhibits protons from being pumped into the stomach to make acid. It's the hydrogen pump. That's, you know, the body basically creates a large hydrogen gradient in the stomach to make that acidic environment. But that's what a proton pump is. It's a hydrogen pump, basically putting hydrogens in one location. Another way to look at the sphere of hydration is the affinity a molecule has for water. So there's, you know, lipophilic and hydrophilic, or hydrophobic and lipophobic. There's different ways of looking at the definitions. Water is made up of two hydrogens and one oxygen molecule. Oxygen is a very negative molecule. Not that it's like Eeyore, but it means that when oxygen is bound to another atom, it still has a strong partial negative charge and will be attracted to positive charges. So think of like the opposite attract thing of magnets. You know, you have the north and south pole. If you just switch them up to positive and negative, you're looking at, you know, a negative being attracted to a positive. The hydrogens in water therefore will become partially positively charged. So if the charge becomes more negative on the oxygen, then that makes the hydrogens to be more positive, which then makes them attracted to negative charges. Excuse me. These partial charges are what make water agglomerate together and also form surface tension. That's why water is so good, you know, solvent, because it has partial positive and partial negatives to then dissolve things that have positive or negative charges, like salt. Salt will break into a positive sodium charge. Chloride is a negative charge, and that dissolves very well in water. Not all molecules will have a charge. If they don't have the capability to ionize, depending on their structure, then it's not possible. Molecules that have more oxygen or nitrogen molecules have a higher chance of becoming charged. This splits the molecules into two main types of groups, hydrophilic and lipophilic. So hydrophilic, water-loving, lipophilic, lipid-loving. The less charge they have, the more lipophilic they are. The more charge they have, the more hydrophilic they are. This is an example of how a molecule can look. All the corners, or all the points that you see here, they're all carbons, and carbon is annotated with a C, and nitrogen is an N, O is oxygen. Those are the three biggest molecules utilized in organic chemistry, or the, you know, what we're composed of when we're talking about all the molecules in the vitamins and the in the body, proteins, etc. And this just demonstrates as a lipid membrane in a cell. So it's fats compose the entire membrane of a cell. Cholesterol is found in here, and then proteins are found in the channels here as well. Lipophilic molecules tend to be attracted to the lipid membrane found on the outside of all cells. Cells line the intestine, and the lipophilic molecules will tend to merge into the cellular membrane to avoid the watery intestinal environment, because they want to get out of the water and into the lipid. Therefore, they're easier to be absorbed. Hydrophilic molecules, on the other hand, want to stay in the water and, you know, not go into the lipid membrane. So they prefer the intestinal environment and are repelled by it, repelled by the lipid membrane. This can lead to the absorption issues that we're talking about. If a lot of molecules are trying to go through the channel at the same time, so let's say this one channel here, if there's like 100 thiamine molecules that want to get into here, you know, they can only go in one at a time. It's not like you can put it, you know, you can't fit 100 of them. They may be exactly the right size and the shape to allow one molecule of whatever they're transporting. So then, you know, the one makes it in here, and the intestinal movement moves Oops, I've just realized my pointer is on the wrong screen. I'm sorry. Let me do the diagram again. These points here are carbon molecules, and the C is designated carbon, and the N is nitrogen, O is oxygen, and this is the lipid membrane. So the lipids on the cell, and there's cholesterol in there as well. And these are the hydrophilic, the channels through the membrane. So you have one thiamine, let's say, going in this way. It can go both ways, which is why the arrow shows in and out. So if you have one thiamine in here, the other 99 that are trying to get in, the intestinal movement will make them continue down the line across. Now, that's not a perfect example of exactly how things work, because there's tons and tons and tons of these channels all over each cell membrane. And there are millions, if not hundreds of millions, I'm not sure exactly what the number is, of cells that line the intestinal wall. So you have tons of opportunity for the thyme to get absorbed, but it's kind of like a broken down example of how to think about things. It creates like that whole, like, you know, three guys trying to get through the one doorway at the same time. It doesn't happen. Nothing gets through. So if you have limited channels to allow things through, you get absorption issues. So it can become an inconvenience as far as having limited channels, but it's not a complete blockage. The more you supplement things in the diet, or supplement things, in the diet, the more molecules there are, with the higher chance of them being absorbed. Because if you only have 100 molecules, that all 100 being absorbed, you have potential for more to go through, right? So if you put 1,000 in there, then maybe 800 will get absorbed. So you end up, you know, pushing things one way or the other, depending on what you're trying to supplement. That's not saying more is always better. Again, doses of vitamins can be an issue, especially the fat-soluble vitamins. This is a diagram of the citric acid cycle, kind of showing where things play a role for different B vitamins, manganese, magnesium, biotin, carnitine, for example. Everything feeding into the citric acid cycle that might be, like this, the urea cycle, it's its own cycle, electron transport chain, what it can use. So it's not just the one cycle by itself. But the point of this diagram is to show you that there are many, many different vitamins and minerals and cofactors that are in there. And they're utilized for a lot of different functionalities in the body, not just here. Everything in the body is interlinked, and pointing to one particular pathway as being like the most important pathway isn't really possible. In order for cells to function, they need proteins, which means DNA has to be coded into RNA, and that's decoded into proteins. But nutrients are needed in order to make proteins, so absorption has to happen, and the nutrients need to be broken down into the building blocks and then assembled, which requires proteins, which requires DNA to be coded to RNA, et cetera, et cetera. It's a constant, you know, need, bottleneck type thing or whatever in the body. Along each step of the way, proteins may need helper molecules like vitamins and cofactors to do their jobs. The vitamins may contribute methyl groups or other functional groups to assist the breakdown. They may be required as sacrificial pieces in order to accept electrons from the breakdown product or provide another functional group. Minerals are generally used by the active pocket of proteins or enzymes to catalyze the reaction. And that's because minerals are usually metals, like manganese, magnesium, and they're great for donating or accepting electrons, which makes the enzyme much more efficient in its work. Think of the catalytic converter in your car. It takes carbon monoxide and it passes it over a nickel palladium alloy in, like, basically it's air being pushed through a nickel palladium filter. And that allows the carbon dioxide to snap, and it makes it into CO2 or other byproducts that are less harmful than carbon monoxide. I think there's a couple other things in there. That's the metal doing all the work. You never utilize your entire catalytic converter in the lifetime of your car, because it's, you know, it just keeps regenerating the electrical charge electrons that are in there. But that's the same kind of concept. Your proteins use the metals as that kind of catalytic converter in the pocket. This diagram we had in the previous lecture, I was a little bit harder to see, so I was able to get it to kind of came up rather well. And it shows again B2, this is the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. So like, B2, selenium, and we talked a little bit with this with Stephanie with caffeine. It just is noted in there that it has a binding, and we know that caffeine affects metabolism because when you take it, you get jittery for the most part. Granted, not everybody might have the same reaction, but it's a metabolic, not booster, but it influences metabolism to happen faster, basically. Not recommending caffeine as a supplement for mito patients. It's not recommended as far as I know, but it's just something to note that it does bind into the electron transport chain here. Selenium, again, another metal supplement that we use, but we only need very, very small amounts of it because the body really never gets rid of it. And then we're looking at like different other cycles again that are feeding into the electron transport chain. So you have the TCA cycle or citric acid cycle or the Krebs cycle. And that gets fed into, and it needs like B12, zinc, B1, B5. So again, you're looking at tons and tons of different mechanisms that are feeding into trying to get energy. So it's not like one thing you can point to at any given point. If one or more of the steps in the energy production cycles are deficient in vitamins or minerals, supplementing can help those steps be more efficient. Usually that's the case when absorption of the vitamin or mineral is lacking or deficient. That can be from like poor diet or from poor absorption of GI tract due to GI issues or transport issues. The tougher part is when the proteins or the enzymes in the energy production cycles are deficient or faulty. It creates bottlenecks in the energy production cycles. And as we saw in part one, some of those cycles are reversible, meaning if the body sees too much end product building up, or not even end product, like a step in there building up, it'll actually reverse the process to stop producing so much of this excess product. It'd be almost like if you're building, let's say you're in Ford and you're building F-150s and you have way too many doors that you need. So you're going to stop the process, there and just kind of make people go backwards and make something else, not doors. We can control assembly lines for vehicles and for other things a lot better. So we can actually just make exactly the amount of doors for cars that will be made for the day. So we have some control of it, but biochemically, we don't have any real control. The body will shunt resources to another cycle to create energy since the final end product is not being produced enough. This isn't always efficient since the primary energy production cycles are much more prodigious in energy productions than the backup cycles. Also, if you've done any research or looked into it, you have the general metabolic deficiency shape of like somebody gets like a lot of waste fat basically, and they get the pear shape. And that's because the body takes, if you're not producing or not taking glucose very well and producing energy very well from it, your body just turns around, turns it into fat, and then your body stores it around the waist area, and you keep getting this kind of pear shaped. And it's called metabolic disorder, metabolic syndrome. It's related to different causalities. And as you can see, several vitamins, minerals, cofactors, and ETC, like B2, E, selenium, melatonin, CoQ10, and others in the ancillary processes, which are processes that contribute to the Krebs cycle directly, which in turn feeds NADH into the electron transport chain. Other nutrients are utilized like B1, B5, B12, C, zinc, creatine, et cetera. There's no perfect way of assessing what supplement with what deficiency, even if you have diagnosed genetic deficiencies, because the utilization is so complex. That's why a lot of mitochondrial doses are trial and error and depend on patient response versus getting proper blood levels of vitamins targeted or assessed. Targeting blood levels of vitamins or minerals only determines that those nutrients are being absorbed into the blood, not necessarily if they're being utilized by the cellular mechanisms that require it. The only way that I know of to do that is like, let's say you know that step 1 to 2 requires thiamine to be used, and then you measure the product of step 2. If there's very little of it, then maybe the thiamine is not being utilized properly. Like that's the only way I can think of how you do it. I don't know if in practicality, if that is something to be assessed. Again, that's more because I get asked this question a lot. That's more talking with your metabolic doctor or geneticist, because they might have better ideas of testing and test results, et cetera, for as far as that goes. So supplementing with additional vitamins, cofactors, and minerals, even if no deficiency in those items exists, may help make processes easier on the cycles and lead to less bottlenecks. I'm going to try and go through a couple of examples here. A little bit complicated, so I apologize if I lose anybody, but just keep in mind that I'm just trying to give you an idea of efficiency of cycles. So for example, if a protein in the Krebs cycle converts a molecule from A to B and requires the use of thiamine, it waits to complete that step until both molecule A and thiamine are attached to the protein and it makes that reaction happen. Now, if the protein is inefficient in doing its job, meaning there are less of those proteins available, then and there's an excess of molecule A and very little conversion of molecule to B will happen. If thiamine is present in normal levels, then the chance for a protein to grab it and molecule A is normal. However, if thiamine is increased in the cell, then the likelihood of the protein getting a thiamine molecule and molecule A is increased, allowing it to have a faster turnaround to convert another molecule from A to B. Meaning if I need like this water bottle every 2 seconds in order for me to talk and I have to take a sip from it, if I have hundreds of water bottles all around me, I can grab them much quicker. And that allows me to take a sip quicker and go to the next step of what I have to do quicker. That's kind of like the point of, supplementation. Another way of looking at it in layman's terms is like, if you need to cook eggs for 100 people, you can either have one person cooking all the eggs or 100 people cooking eggs for 100 people. All right. Now think of what the bottlenecks would be in the situation. Would it be, the stove, the pans, utensils, space? What's the most efficient layout? Are you looking at an industrial kitchen or are you in your house? Now imagine you normally have a staff of 20 to perform this task to cook 100 eggs, but 19 people called out. So it's now all on you to do this. So you have a deficiency of people, or in biochemical terms, the people are proteins. You have to figure out how to rework the situation to be more efficient. You position yourself, the eggs, the utensils, and spices in easy to get locations so you can maximize your work time without ruining the eggs. That repositioning is like supplementation. You make the situation easier to work for you by providing resources more easily. So we'll talk about the individual vitamins and cofactors. So I picked the ones that are the more commonly prescribed vitamins or discussed in the literature, with a couple of additions with Peyton adding for some patient questions from the previous two. So we had part one lecture and then we had a Q&A session in January as well. So I kind of added a few things in based on that stuff. So CoQ10 is the most commonly used supplement in the mitococktail. We also know that it's utilized in the electron transport chain. The two major forms are ubiquinone and ubiquinol. Ubiquinone is the oxidized version of CoQ10 and ubiquinol is the reduced version. Ubiquinol needs to be packaged in a non-oxygen environment because oxygen will oxidize it into ubiquinone. So if you have a bottle of powder, for example, and then you open the bottle, then the powder will start reverting to ubiquinone because it's going to be exposed to oxygen. Ubiquinol in a liquid or liquid gel cap should take longer to oxidize since it's protected from the air. In an acidic environment like the stomach, ubiquinol rapidly gains hydrogen because remember we said gain of a hydrogen is reduction, converting the ubiquinol to the ubiquinone version. Gain of a hydrogen is oxidation. I apologize. So that the second one confused me sometimes. There aren't any studies that have compared the absorption of ubiquinone versus ubiquinol, but we do know that supplementing with either does increase CoQ10 levels in the body. CoQ10 is made both by the body and consumed in food. The process of making CoQ10 in the body is the same pathway in parts as making cholesterol. So taking statins to help reduce cholesterol blocks this pathway and reduces the amount of CoQ10 in the body, which can lead to muscle pains or myalgias and muscle damage. It's also why statins are pretty much not recommended or contraindicated in mitochondrial disorders for that reason. So this is a diagram of the different forms of CoQ10. As you can see, there are tons and tons of those little points, so tons and tons of carbons, very lipophilic, loves to interact with the molecule of the lipid membrane in the body, in the cell, sorry. And this is the oxidized and this is the reduced version. I think Danish or German. I'm not really sure, but it was the best example I could find. Whatever .dk is, I don't know. And this this intermediate version is where you see this little dot here. That's a random electron that it's picked up or is holding on to. And that's how it vacillates between its forms. So that's why it's like the electron gain or loss is happening here. So it's gaining the electron or losing the electron here. It's very stable because this, normally if you have like this O dot, it's very reactive, which is where the reactive oxygen species come from, which I talked about in part one. And those can bind to lipids, DNA, or proteins and can damage them because it'll create this, you know, electrical binding, and it just basically snaps on, and now you have a non-functional unit. But because of this really unique biochemistry of CoQ10, this dot is never really exposed. It's constantly running and running around, and it doesn't make it easy for it to react with other things, which is why CoQ10 is a great antioxidant. They exist in equilibrium in the body, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes because enzymes maintain the balance. The body will use either ubiquinone or ubiquinol, or convert it to the necessary form as needed by whichever process requires it the most. In the electron transport chain, CoQ10 shuttles electrons from complex 1 to 2 and from 2 to 3, which requires CoQ10 to vacillate between the oxidized and reduced forms as it gains an electron from complex 1 and then loses it to complex 2. CoQ10 is not damaged in this process. In general, when CoQ10 encounters free radicals or reactive oxygen species, which are the byproducts of energy production, it'll accept the lone electron if it is in the reduced form, or lose an electron to the free radical if it's in the oxidated form. This process quenches or eliminates the free radical, which prevents it from causing oxidative damage. CoQ10, because of its unique structure, can keep the extra electron moving all around. Then lipoic acid, it's another antioxidant used by the body. It's more water soluble than CoQ10 and much smaller molecule. Like CoQ10, it exists in equilibrium between its oxidized and reduced state. So you have antioxidant now in the cytosol or in the water part of the cell, and you have in the lipid part of the cell, you have another, you have CoQ10, which is very fat soluble. So you have the two major antioxidants in the processes. It's used to replenish specifically glutathione, vitamin C, and CoQ10 from their oxidized to their reduced states. And in that process, NADPH is consumed. So it does take some energy out of the equation in order to replenish things. Glutathione is the body's natural antioxidant, and it's what the body produces. It gets used up sometimes very rapidly in some situations, like Tylenol overdoses, for example. So you have to supplement with an antioxidant in order for that to be replenished so you don't cause liver damage and die. I lost my train of thought for a second. The body sometimes has, in metabolic disorders, has mechanisms that don't allow for quick enough glutathione creation. So by supplementing this, you're basically making the glutathione more effective or more efficient because you're turning it around much quicker. The other situation is glutathione gets rapidly consumed in patients who have a lot of free radicals produced by the oxidative processes of energy production. So again, you're turning around the glutathione a little bit better. And by supplementing lipoic acid, that can sometimes quench those free radicals in and of itself. Vitamin C is a very small, very water-soluble vitamin that acts as an antioxidant in the water space of the cell. Scurvy is a connective tissue disorder that many sailors suffered from because of long voyages. There were no fresh fruits and vegetables on these long voyages. And then citrus fruits were found to contain something in them that, when fed to animals who were deprived of fresh fruits and vegetables, reversed the symptoms of scurvy. Nobody knew what it was, you know, so they just said, okay, well, something in these fruits is very high in it. The British Navy in the 1700s started stocking limes on their ships and were part of the daily rations since they don't spoil readily. All citrus fruits keep for a longer period of time because there was no refrigeration. Vitamin C is readily absorbed and the excess is removed in the urine. Too much vitamin C, which is greater than 6 grams per day, can cause bleeding because it interferes with the clotting processes in the body. So again, some is good, more is not necessarily better. And even something with water solubility, get a pee out the excess can cause problems. Vitamin E is basically vitamin C's counterpart. It's a fat-soluble vitamin, which resides mostly in the membranes of cells and organelles, acting as an antioxidant in those spaces. So already we've hit four antioxidants: lipoic acid, CoQ10, C, and E. You know, big players in the metabolics. Vitamin E may be at the surface of membranes, which allows it to come in contact with vitamin C in the water space of the cell, and they replenish each other. If one is utilized to punch free radicals, the balance is determined by the need of the cell. Vitamin E was studied in the 90s and 2000s in the Framingham Heart Study. Initially, high doses of vitamin E was thought to have cardioprotective effects, but after a few years, it was shown that greater than 400 IUs daily was actually detrimental to heart health. Now, I brought that up because a lot of patients in Mito cocktails have higher than 400 IUs. That's a metabolic need that's different from what was studied. In the Framingham Heart Study, was conducted with patients with cardiac issues, diabetes, or blood pressure diagnoses, but otherwise healthy. So, you know, overdoing their supplementation led to other issues. Whereas in a patient who's deficient in vitamin E, again, based on what your geneticist or metabolic doctor determines, based on either blood work or genetics, may require higher doses than that. And that's why I brought this up. I know it's published data out there that says don't take vitamin E greater than that. And I get questions about that as well. B vitamins. So there's lots of B vitamins. They were starting to be discovered in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They're water soluble, bitter tasting, and have a cereal-like smell. And that's really because a lot of cereals are fortified with B vitamins. It's not so much that the B vitamins smell like cereals, that cereals smell like B vitamins. All are used in multiple functions in the body, with B1 through B6 used in a lot of the metabolic functions for breaking down sugars, proteins, and fats into energy. B7, B9, and B12 are used mostly on cellular functions in order to make new molecules. B6 is also extensively used in the nervous system, helping with the construction of neurotransmitters. B6 deficiencies can occur with certain medications like levetiracetam. A lack of B6 will cause a tingling, numbing of those extremities. Which is kind of interesting because some of the side effects of B vitamins. So like B2 can cause an orangey color in the urine because of bright orange color in itself. B3 can cause skin flushing or niacin flush. It can pre-treat with Benadryl or diphenhydramine or ibuprofen. And then B6 can cause tingling or numbness in doses greater than 600 milligrams per day. So its side effects are actually the same as its, you know, deficiency. When patients take B vitamins, sometimes there are multiple supplements being involved. So you'll have a patient taking a B complex and then another metabolic thing and then a compound potentially with a meta cocktail. And unless they let the doctor or the pharmacist know exactly what's happening or what they're taking and they look at the doses, you can take more than was recommended of the B vitamins, which in B6's situation can lead to, you know, problems you're trying to treat. Like, well, I'm not any better with this neuropathy that I've been having. Well, that it's not that you're not any better. It's just that you're overdosing on the B vitamins. So always be cognizant that supplements that are out there for metabolics have multiple ingredients in them, and more isn't always better. Folic acid, which is vitamin B9, is a key player in healthy cellular growth. Pregnant women require folic acid for proper fetal development. It used to be supplemented during pregnancy, but now since bread, cereals, and other products are fortified with folic acid, as well as other B vitamins, diet alone is enough to supplement pregnant women, which up until the early 2000s apparently wasn't, because they were always being supplemented with multivitamins with folic acid or folic acid by itself. So it's been a lot of changeovers with diet over the years. Since all cells require folic acid to grow, it's a target area for cancer therapy. The only reason I bring this up as an example is because it matters to the cycle of folic acid. So this is the folic acid cycle here, and what it, this is nucleotide. It's a nucleotide for DNA creation. So without certain nucleotides, your body can't produce cells or grow. Folic acid required in order to convert these and add the methyl group here. That's a little stick that's missing on this side. And it allows the creation for DNA. Breaking up this cycle or having a deficiency in the cycle doesn't allow for proper DNA creation, which leads to cellular function problems. So breaking up the cycle with methotrexate inhibits cellular growth. So in the folic acid cycle, the folic acid is going through several steps: dihydrofolate, tetrahydrofolate, and folinic acid, or folinic acid, also known as leucophorin. Some people have deficiencies in the folic acid enzymes that keep this cycle going and therefore are not able to utilize folic acid properly. So supplementing with the intermediate steps of, you know, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate or leucophorin is possible to overcome those blocks. And that's what we're seeing right here: dihydrofolate, tetrahydrofolate, and folinic acid. This you can measure through blood levels, seeing where you are, and you know you're having a methylation issue, because all these steps are just continuous methylation changes, and this is where methotrexate is blocking one of the key steps in here. So that's another way that blood levels will tell deficiencies, or you know what you should supplement with. Vitamin B12 affects several cycles directly, including the folic acid cycle, the Krebs cycle, and the methionine cycle. A small amount of B12 does go a long way. The body stores excess B12 in the liver, holding up to a 3-month supply at any given time. Like folic acid, microgram doses are needed in a supplementation. Unlike folic acid is excreted anything in excess. The body doesn't store it long-term. And B12 is one of the few vitamins that has an injectable version that can be done at home. The 3 different versions of B12 are the different steps in the B12 utilization, again, in the body. So like folic acid, supplementing with any of the 3 steps is fine if there are deficiencies in proteins producing the different types of B12. So, I'm sorry. I meant to have another image here that had the methyl B12 in the different cycle. But noticing that, you know, adenosyl B12, methyl B12 are in here. I apologize. I had another picture that didn't make it into here that showed the different forms of it: the cyanocobalamin, hydroxycobalamin, methylcobalamin. And those are the 3 things you can supplement with. B12 absorption is different than any other of the vitamins. Intrinsic factor, this IF that you're seeing here, is released in a specific area of the stomach, which binds to B12, making it absorbable in the intestine. Otherwise, B12 is such a big molecule, it doesn't get absorbed. And it's kind of like a tag saying, yeah, we want this to come in. This is true for B12 that is swallowed either in food or from supplements. Some people will have antibodies that attack the binding of intrinsic factor, IF, making IF impossible to bind B12, and therefore can't absorb the oral doses of B12. The antibodies are basically this big thing that will bind the IF, and then the active part of IF doesn't get to bind the B12, which is why, you know, you have that problem. It's an autoimmune disorder, basically. Other people have gastric bypass surgeries, and that may damage or remove the part of the stomach that releases IF, again, not allowing for B12 to be absorbed. The way to overcome IF insufficiencies is to inject B12 into the muscle tissue. Depending on the severity of the deficiency, 1,000 micrograms can be injected either weekly, monthly, or every 3 months. Because again, your body holds onto and utilizes B12 very, very efficiently. Folic acid, iron, and B12 deficiencies, either individually or more than one being present at the same time, can lead to anemias since they are critical to red blood cell growth. Supplementing will help improve anemias, and it may be a temporary situation or supplements may be necessary for life, again, depending on what's going on. Having a normal B12 level in the blood, but still having symptoms of a B12 deficiency is a rare situation. Basically, the body is unable to use B12 well in its pathways. supplementing may help with the situation since you're providing more B12 for the body to have and make use of. Creatine. So creatine monohydrate is also known as muscle milk. It doesn't dissolve very easily in water, and when shaken, makes a temporary milky suspension. The body makes creatine, and the majority of the creatine exists in the muscles. Creatine is used and destroyed constantly by the muscles, and the byproduct is creatinine, a molecule that is 100% eliminated by the kidney. Since it is always and only eliminated by the kidney, it's a great marker of kidney function and is measured in the blood during a normal blood test. Elevated serum creatinine is an indicator of kidney damage or failure since it's building up in the blood and not being removed, which means other things that are filtered out from the blood by the kidneys are not being carried out properly and can cause issues. Adding creatine as a supplement will increase the level of serum creatinine levels in the body, in the blood. If your doctor isn't aware that you're taking a lot of creatine orally, they may think you have a kidney issue. So always inform your doctor, primary care, doesn't matter, everyone who's in your care team, of what you're on, because more information for them is better. Creatine itself does not create any energy, nor does it store any energy. Creatine is linked to a phosphate. Now you have to remember that ATP has three phosphates, ADP has two phosphates, and AMP has one phosphate. ATP is the molecule for energy. Phosphate is the currency of energy. So creatine linked to the phosphate is a good storage for phosphate since it can readily release its phosphate and give it to ADP to make ATP quickly. And this bypasses the whole electron transport chain. Muscles that are under stress, meaning they don't have quick access to oxygen, like when you're running, will start using creatine phosphate to make ATP versus the usual electron transport chain. Because the electron transport chain requires oxygen. That's why it's called, you know, oxidative respiration, creating energy from oxygen. Whereas this is kind of like the cheap way of doing it. So we've been asked about citrulline as well. Citrulline is an amino acid. So ammonia is a toxic byproduct of the breakdown of amino acids. And you need to break down amino acids as a normal functionality, again, whether you're using for linking them together or to make a protein, or if you're using them to break it down for energy production. In humans, you can't excrete ammonia directly. It needs to be converted to a less corrosive molecule, or urea. Birds and snakes and lizards and all that, they can actually release ammonia by itself. It doesn't need to be converted to urea. Ammonia buildup in the blood causes an alkaline shift in the pH of the blood, and the body's reaction is to flood the brain and the nervous system with water to dilute the ammonia, trying to protect the brain from damage by the alkalinity it's experiencing. The influx of a lot of water into the brain, which doesn't have a lot of excess space in there, will cause a lot of swelling in the brain, and that leads to a lot of pressure, which in turn can cause damage to the brain. The urea cycle, like all cycles, can be assessed from any point at the starting point as the cycle, but most commonly you're looking at it when ammonia starts to enter the cycle. Any of the three major points in the cycle, arginine, citrulline, or ornithine can be supplemented if there's a deficiency in the enzyme pathway in the urea cycle, preventing the conversion of one element to another as needed. So this was citrulline, arginine, ornithine. Arginine is something that's it's an amino acid that is found in food. It's not, I was under the mistaken impression as I was doing this, there's 20 essential amino acids. There's actually 9 essential amino acids. There's 20 amino acids that are utilized to produce proteins. But I'd always learned them as essential when I was younger, so I had that misnomer in my head for a long time. Most amino acids are found in food proteins specifically, but there's some of them that you have to, that you can produce. All amino acids are found in proteins or food. 9 of them your body cannot produce, which means you can only get them from food. And then 11 of them, your body produces them anyways from other products, so you can get by without eating them. And then taurine was another question we had asked. Taurine is a controversial topic. I put this diagram on here because it showed that there's a lot of functions of taurine that are touted. We do know that taurine is used by complex one and complex three in the electron transport chain. It's utilized by muscles during exercise. There has been some benefit shown in patients with heart failure using taurine. Past that, not much has been studied, or any in-depth information is provided. Taurine deficiency may affect mitochondrial disorder negatively, and supplementing with taurine may help improve symptoms, but it's not been studied directly or discussed in any of the most recently published mitochondrial literature. So supplementing with taurine is something to discuss with your metabolic doctor, see if there's a need or a potential benefit. There's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of websites and supplements that say, yes, yes, taurine this, taurine that, but I don't know the answer, unfortunately. And then patients asked us about TRIM7 or Dolavent or MCT or Dojolvi oil and lipid absorption. So to speak to this in general about OTC supplements, there's lots of questions out there and there are lots of products. I can't speak to any brands or specific products, but I can tell you a few general facts about OTC supplements. No OTC supplement is tested for quality or concentration. There are no FDA regulated supplements. So there's no requirements by anybody who produces a supplement to do anything really other than produce something. Some companies will undergo testing of their products voluntarily, and they will usually have it posted on their website. Usually it's a statement or a seal that says tested under CGMP. CGMP is commonly good manufactured processes that are outlined by the FDA for all pharmaceutical companies, those that make drugs, and are held to that specific standard, which includes testing of sourcing material and material. Usually the companies that undergo this testing will have a higher price for their OTC supplements, but that's because they have more overhead since they're doing additional testing or manufacturing steps that they're not required to do, and that increases costs. So do your research before buying OTC supplements, you know, check websites or call manufacturers directly. I do know in the 2000s, might have been more recent studies for it, I can't remember. Popular brands of vitamins were randomly tested by consumer groups. One vitamin, multivitamin, was found to have literally nothing in it, just like talc. That was it. Another brand of vitamins that they tested had well below or way high percentages of what they were stating on their labeling. Supplement company had lead, arsenic, other heavy metals, not in toxic amounts, but in higher than normally consumed or allowed by the FDA in foods or medications or medication supplement things, like if they were from a pharmacy, because we have to purchase things from a FDA approved wholesaler who purchases it from an FDA approved manufacturer, and it has to meet USP standards, United States Pharmacopeia standards, in order for us to be able to bring it in, which means that it has a certificate of analysis, underwent a lot of testing, et cetera. All pharmacies are required to do that per federal and state laws. Well, federal laws, not every state is where I'm in. So I don't know what the state rules are, what they hold everybody to, but that's a different topic discussion. So that's things to consider and think about. And as far as oils, when taking oils orally, they form spheres because they're fat. They're lipophilic. They squeeze out all the water as possible, because they get as tight little balls as possible. Since they're hydrophobic, the movement of the GI tract, you know, the peristaltic movements or whatever, will squeeze the oils, because you have a collapsed tube as your intestine and it's constantly pushing things. But you know, there's not these giant balls of oil. It's just these agglomerations of oil. And breaks them up to some extent, but they still like to kind of get together, and they create, you know, larger clusters that are hard to absorb, and they travel down the GI tract, creating a lubricant effect along the way. So too much oil will lead to oily stools, basically. Breaking down the doses into smaller amounts or pairing them with foods that contain some fat will help mitigate this, since smaller oil agglomerates will be made. The oil emulsifies with the food that may contain fat in it. So that's kind of like the whole point behind spreading it out or taking it with food. And then there was another question about uncoordinated esophageal muscles and nutrient absorption. Muscle spasms or uncoordinated muscle movements or lack of movement of muscles in the esophagus won't affect absorption directly of any nutrients because there's no absorption happening in the esophagus. If muscle movements in the esophagus don't allow food to travel farther down to the GI tract, so into the stomach, small intestine, et cetera, then yeah, there's absorption issues because no nutrition is being consumed and passed into the small and large intestines. Usually when there are swallowing difficulties, a liquid-based diet is assessed and maybe prescribed. Or a patient may have a feeding tube like a J or G tube to help bypass the barrier to the nutritional absorption, depending on what the severity of the situation is and what the healthcare provider may determine. So those are all possibilities. And then the last slide that I have on here, just want to go to quickly, was all the different vitamins we talked about, plus some additional ones like vitamin A, vitamin K. Their chemical structure, so you can see if they're big or small. They contain a lot of those points or carbons or a lot of oxygens and nitrogens. Gives you a determination more if they're water soluble versus fat soluble. So like this vitamin D, for example, fat soluble, has only one O. Vitamin C, look at all the oxygens that are in there. So it's very water soluble. And then vitamin E looks almost similar to CoQ10 in structure. It's got that long chain thing. So I wanted to show you like the different structures that are in here.
Want to keep your slide, normally we have presenters undo their slideshow, but I'm wondering if you might want to keep it up because you might, with some of the questions that came in, I think they're pretty technical. So you might want to go back and share certain pictures. Before we hit the questions that are in the chat, you mentioned earlier the type of testing that over-the-counter supplements can do, that some do, and you had a name for it. It's and I was curious what the name was, if you could say that again.
CGMP.
And is that the same thing as third-party testing?
Third-party testing just means it's another, like, let's say I make it here, I send it to another lab to test it. That's third-party testing instead of me testing it here in my facility. Third-party testing is preferred because you're less likely to cheat the system because the other vendor doesn't have a financial obligation to you other than you're paying them to test something. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, hey, the test went, it was below what it should have been. That's not my problem. You got to solve your problem on your side. Whereas, you know, you might have a testing group inside your company. We don't, because we can't afford that, that, you know, would feel pressure to pass something through. And because, you know, it's the same management, same whatever, and like, this probably doesn't go out, the company losing millions of dollars. So that's the difference between third-party testing and just testing in general. But either lab can do CGMP testing. It doesn't matter. And if you adhere to CGMP, it's just, you know, you adhere to it, yes or no. But third-party testing is a little bit nicer from that standpoint.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for clarifying that. Yeah. There's a lot of great questions that came through the chat, and you just had the B vitamin chart up. So I'm going to start with some of the B vitamin questions because there's a group of them. The first one is B12. It says best B12 to take methacholine. I'm not going to say that word right. Mm-hmm.
Again, it doesn't really matter. It is that cycle. You can enter at any given point. If you have a methylation problem, which can be tested from a genetic standpoint, because you can tell if that enzyme that does a conversion is deficient or not. If it is deficient, then take the methylcobalamin because your body can't make the methylcobalamin. If it comes back as normal, it doesn't really matter which one you're taking.
So this kind of plays on that too, I think, a little bit. She asks, isn't cyclobalamin, how do you say that word?
Cyanocobalamin.
Thank you. A synthetic form of B12, and is it attached to a cyanide molecule? And the body has to use existing Kabbalim in order to change it to the usable methylkobalamin, the usable form of B12?
So I wish, you know what? Give me 1 second. Let me see if I can bring up a structure of vitamin B12.
All right.
So I'm going to quit out of the show. This.
Oh, nice trees.
Oh, no, yeah, that's from Hawaii. When I was in farm school, a friend of mine moved there, so I got to visit her. Those are like the, what do you call it, strangling fig trees. I know some of the sources for this stuff is not like this is from Wikipedia, this, but it's just the general design. We're not, you know, trying to do like anything, you know, overly professional, I guess, or whatever. Like, yeah, there is a cyanide right there, but that's just a functional group. It doesn't break off and become something toxic. You need vitamin B12. Cyanocobalamin is not synthetic. It's something that is in wherever B12 exists. This is a normal, natural form, if you will, for it. But again, you don't take in just cyanocobalamin, because if you eat cow, they're producing cyanocobalamin, methylcobalamin, hydroxycobalamin. So you're supplementing all that stuff at the same time. Your body really will preferentially take cyanocobalamin in. When you supplement, the only supplements that are available, well, not the only supplements, the most prodigiously available ones are cyanocobalamin. The methyl and hydroxycobalamin are rarer to find. They're harder to produce. And I think that that's why. And unless you have methylation issues to move them along that cycle pathway again, you're not going to really supplement with those.
So what is chronically, another patient asked, what is chronically, being chronically low in B12 indicate? And I'm going to throw in another question, because another patient asked, every time that their blood is drawn, B6 is high. So so low B12,
okay,
high B6, are there things that come to mind?
So low B12, it's, you know, if you're chronically low in it, then it sounds like it's an absorption issue. Again, if there's the intrinsic factor thing, you know, you don't know unless you do an anti-IF antibody test, titer. That'll determine whether your body is producing anti-IF antibodies. Really can't say that very quickly. Which, if it is, then you're going to have a harder time absorbing B12 or not be able to absorb B12. If it comes back negative, then you just may have a propensity to lower intrinsic factor in general and have a harder time absorbing it. Usually cases like that, you do injections because you can't pull it in. And again, hydroxycobalamin and methylcobalamin are, again, these big molecules are going to require that IF in order to pull them across. It's not exclusively cyanocobalamin. So like, oh, I can't do B12, but I can do hydroxo. It's not going to matter from an oral perspective. There
now,
are,
if you're getting the injections, because she mentioned that she's getting the injections and she's still not like up to level.
That I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something to discuss with the doctor. Because that's, once you have an injection, it's 100. It's basically considered 100% absorption. So something else is going on that I don't know. I'm sorry.
No, but that's helpful. That's really helpful to know where to start. What about B6 being high? Is that, and do you know that to be?
Look at your diet.
Indication.
That's what I would tell the patient. Look at, you know, your supplements that you're on, how many milligrams of B6 is found in all the different supplements or prescription medications that you're taking. And just look, they're going to be in food too. So like, if you know, cereals or breads or anything like that, there's B6. So look at all the ingredients that are on there, and the nutritional values. Sometimes they aren't listed, like in bread, I think it's just listed as like contains B6, not listed percent daily value. Sometimes they are. I think in some cereals, they have them listed because they're proud of all the vitamins that can be in there. So, you know, assess that and assess what, you know, what else is necessary in those other things. And is there a source you can cut out the B6 potentially? As long as you're not getting that numbness, tingling effect from it, you're not in the, I wouldn't say harmful range. It doesn't feel good. Like, there's no point in being that high because you just feel like these like paresthesias or pins and needles, that kind of stuff, whatever. Neuropathies, that's what we're looking for, neuropathy feelings.
Is there a substitute for leucovorin?
Leucovorin? Either leucovorin, folic acid, or 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. Those are the three available forms of folic acid that can be supplemented. And again, depending on where, if you have that methylation test done for folic acid, because there's different, you know, different enzymes are involved in the methylation processes. If you methylate okay, then you can start with folic acid. Patients who have a cerebral spinal folate deficiency require leucovorin. I believe it's because it's absorbed into the blood, through the blood-brain barrier, into the cerebral spinal fluid, and therefore the brain and spine, more readily, from my understanding. If you're on cancer therapy with methotrexate or other things that block that folic acid cycle, actually, let me bring that up again since we're talking. So if you're using methotrexate or something else that blocks this cycle from happening, then you need to substitute with something else in order to rescue, because you know you can't block all this functionality, otherwise you'll die. You know, I mean, your cells do need to grow. Obviously hair, skin, nails, intestinal stuff, whatever, is all critical to your ability to function. So if you block this 100%, it's chemotherapy basically. So it's just trying to get that balance in there. I don't know if that really answered the question, but it's not necessary you can do leucovorin, but those are the ones that are in that cycle.
What are the best fillers for CoQ10?
Like fillers, like, they're found in commercial drug products, like over-the-counter supplements, or?
They don't specify. So if you ask the question, you feel free to clarify in the chat, but also feel free, Ted, to answer to your leisure.
So fillers are necessary. When you're making a capsule, you can't just weigh out perfectly the powder that you're looking for. You have to mix it in with something else to then spread it out amongst multiple capsules. There's no machine that drops exactly the stuff that you want into a capsule. Basically, how they work is, like, we have a small scale version, but from an industrial standpoint, if it's a powder capsule, you mix all these powders all together and you drop them in to this tray with open capsules. It pushes them down, moves it around again, presses them down again. It goes through all these steps. It's a quicker manufacturing process. We use microcrystalline cellulose, which is an inert, undigestible, unabsorbable fiber that's sourced from a pine tree, considered hypoallergenic in general, or at least low allergenic capacity. Even if you're allergic to pine, you're allergic to pine pollen, not cellulose. It has a fairly low interactive standpoint with chemicals, so it doesn't bind them and makes them unabsorbable. So that's why we chose it for pretty much all of our capsules. We don't use, like, lactose and stuff like that. There are things that are cheaper or utilized by drug companies for certain reasons. Like, if you have a tablet, when you press all those powders to make a tablet, there's no glue holding it together. It's literally the pressure of the thing put together. And then you need to dissolve again in the GI tract. So you need certain things like glidants in order to make that pressing happen and then break apart. So they'll use stuff like talc, magnesium stearate, other things, lactose filler, again, because you need to make that space, because when you create tablets, you're basically making a capsule, but you're pressing it down to be this hard, compact lump that won't break down by shaking the bottle and transport or anything like that. But it should dissolve in the pH of either the stomach or the small intestine. That's why if you drop a tablet in water, it doesn't always dissolve, because that's pH 7. If it's designed to dissolve in the stomach, that's pH 2. And your intestine is pH 8.
I like that visual. That's really helpful to understand why you drop a tablet into water and it doesn't dissolve. And that's intentional.
Yeah, and then so like the rapid dissolve tablets that are utilized. So like ondansetron rapid dissolve for like nausea, you put it on your tongue, it dissolves fairly quickly. Like the Benadryl strips, I'm saying, diphenhydramine strips. Sorry, not, no brand names. Diphenhydramine strips or whatever, they're Tylenol or acetaminophen strips that you use for fever and stuff like that. Those things are designed to dissolve in pH 7 because that's your mouth, because you want it to dissolve in your mouth. So if you put that in water, it'll dissolve fairly rapidly. So that's that. But no, so that's why they use some fillers. Sometimes, like if you're making liquids, you use emulsifying agents because the drug itself won't stay in liquid form. So like if I put CoQ10 in water, you're gonna get this scummy layer of CoQ10 that looks like it's wet on the outside, but it really isn't, and this dry powder pellets on the inside because again, it's hydrophobic, it's very lipophilic. And you can shake as much as you want, you just get these little clumps of stuff everywhere. It's not, and it'll just float to the top real quickly. So you have to add suspending agents and solubilizers and solvents and stuff like that, emulsifying agents like polysorbates or Corrigian gum and a few other things, whatever. I can't remember. I know what we use, but I can't remember what's ever in all the fillers, whatever. Acacia is a good emulsifier too, because basically what those are, they bridge the gap between the hydrophobic and lipophobic. So they have parts of themselves that are very water soluble, so they stick this leg out into the water and they grip a whole bunch of water, and then they have a very lipid soluble part, so they stick this out and they grab the drug, and so that brings them together with the molecule in between.
Do you know why often the CoQ10 is suspended in MCT oil specifically rather than another LCT-based product?
Yeah, so MCT oil is fairly inexpensive, and it's fairly it's small, medium chain triglycerides or whatever. So it's fairly easily to mix something in, and it won't separate itself out again because its affinity for each other isn't as strong. It's a less viscous liquid versus something like olive oil has long chains with its like kinks or whatever that can freeze very easily in colder temperatures, whereas MCT oil doesn't. And that it tends to like solidify or stay in itself and squeeze out stuff that's not itself a little bit more. Whereas the thinner, smaller molecules, they don't stack very well on top of each other, medium chain triglycerides versus long chain triglycerides. And it allows for the drug to kind of disperse a little bit better in there.
So this patient asked, she said, any ideas why someone would not tolerate ubiquinol? She has primary adrenal insufficiency, but both of the times that she's tried CoQ10 as ubiquinol, it has tanked her cortisol levels, caused symptoms of very low cortisol, almost to the point of adrenal crisis. Any ideas for how someone could supplement with CoQ10 still?
Well, I mean,
Understanding that you're not giving medical advice, but
no,
like
yeah, no.
it's,
I mean, that's,
yeah.
I mean, I forward me that question, see if I can find some research on it, because I've never heard that before. I didn't think CoQ10 would have an impact on other hormones, or not other, on hormones in general, because it's not a molecule that has any cellular signaling that I'm aware of. Usually what happens is like, trying to think of a good example. Some chemicals that you ingest, and when I say chemicals, I mean medications or supplements or anything like that, that's not something that you're taking in food, can mimic or trigger cellular functions because they mimic cellular signals. So that sounds to me like something is triggering the I can't remember if it's the pituitary or hypothalamus. It's one of the controller parts of the adrenal pathway, HPA axis, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal. And it's telling it to tell the kidneys to stop producing cortisol. Cortisol is usually produced in the daytime. It's awake, like, it peaks at like 4 or 5 in the morning. It's part of the sleep-wake cycle, and it'll peak around like 4 or 5 in the morning to kind of jar you awake, and so you can deal with that shock of waking up. And it's triggered by the light infiltrates through your eye to some extent. It's also histamine and melatonin affect that. throughout the day, you know, you get some spikes, but you have a base level of it, so you can deal with stressors that happen. Usually when you take exogenous steroids like prednisone or hydrocortisone from pills, your adrenals shut down because they're like, wait, I got too much steroid in here. I don't need to produce more. And that's why they do those titration doses to come off it. So your adrenals will ramp themselves back up. Otherwise you have a shock to the system that can cause other problems vascularly and immunologically. But I've never heard of CoQ10 specifically. So I'll do some digging on that one. I'll let you know. Then you can pass it back to whoever sent it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We truly appreciate you trying to think through that on the spot, and absolutely look forward to maybe some things that you dig up. So we appreciate you doing that. We have one more question. We appreciate you staying with us a little longer. This patient asked, carnitine supplementation is believed by some to increase significant risk of CVD. So this has been removed from some of the cocktails, but she said, this is an excellent energy boost. She feels like it's a big loss. Any solution to this quandary or other thoughts about carnitine supplementation?
So carnitine, I'm trying to remember the wording of this. So I remember when they did the publication for it. It's very rare for somebody to have a carnitine insufficiency. What carnitine does is that it helps fatty acids be transported across the membrane of the mitochondria into the first set where it can undergo fatty oxidation. Carnitine transferase binds levocarnitine to fatty acid, then it can go through the membrane and then goes on the other side. Carnitine is present and created by the body constantly. It's also present very easily in foods, specifically meat products. It's got a very fishy smell because of the nitrogen. It's a water-soluble molecule. I was trying to work through what the discussion was on this thing. I think it was because there's not so many people who actually lack carnitine in their body, that it makes it a difference to actually supplement patients with it, because it's available in plenty that the body doesn't have a problem transferring across. Now, if you have fatty acid oxidation deficiency, I believe carnitine is still number one supplement to kind of help push that along. And I think riboflavin, excuse me, is also utilized as a supplement in that situation. I can't remember the details of that. The risk for the CV incidences were high enough or significant enough, both in children and adults. That's what triggered this, because they were doing a study on it. And if I remember correctly, there were some mito patients involved in that study. They were doing this for patients who were like on like valproic acid, because that drug depletes carnitine. So sometimes they have to supplement with it, or it's a rescue in carnitine toxicity. I mean, in valproic acid toxicity is carnitine. I just can't remember the wording, but that's kind of the general concept. I think I over-explained that, or kind of got lost in my explanation, but I think it's because in general, you don't have that need that's that high unless you have a deficiency. And then the detrimental risk is fairly significant, that it's not worth the risk, especially patients who I think have like NELOS, if I remember correctly. You have stroke-like symptoms where you have like vasoconstriction, it becomes even higher risk, from my understanding. So
patients are still working with their doctors to see if carnitine supplementation is helpful for them, like, and they can supplement it outside of their cocktail, even if they're low in carnitine, or if the doctor feels like the risk outweighs the cons, or depending on the literature, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's not like a contraindication, like don't do it or anything like that, but there's specific instances where like you can do blood tests and figure out, yeah, this is necessary. That's not based on genetics or the lack of carnitine in the blood, for example, or something like that. And again, this is within those realms. Levocarnitine is available over the counter, if I remember correctly, as well as a supplementation. But again, it's also a prescription item. I would hesitate supplementing on it on your own without doctor's permission, just because of the risk. Some things that were supplements or available to allowed to become over the counter, not necessarily that they're safe, like Tylenol, like an overdose on Tylenol or even ibuprofen very readily and cause a lot of problems. So just, be cognizant of that.
Yeah, it's very wise. And I think it's a good note to end on, in the sense that all of these supplements, if they can be helpful, they can be harmful, and which is why it's so important to work with your doctor. So even if they can't track, like you mentioned earlier in the presentation, that when you look at different supplements, you're looking at it in the blood, you don't know what's going on necessarily on a cellular level. But it's still important for the doctors to be aware, because then they can test and make sure that your kidney functions are okay, or make sure that other things are functioning properly amidst either increasing a supplement or decreasing a supplement or trying a new one. It's so helpful to try to work together as a team, I think, with your pharmacist and your doctor, so you kind of can piece together how these things are working and working for you. Ted, we just so appreciate you taking the time to dive into all of this. It's a lot, and our bodies are amazing, and how we function every day is amazing, but we really just appreciate you sharing your knowledge and being willing to answer follow-up questions and things like that too. We just so appreciate you. So thanks for joining us. Thank you for everyone that's here today and for diving deep with us into components of the Mito cocktail. Next month, we are going to have Pamela Tucker with us, who's a physical therapist, and she's going to talk about aqua therapy. So a little bit change of pace, but we're super excited. And don't forget that this will be posted in the coming days on our expert series page. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. I hope everybody has a wonderful day.
Thank you for everyone. And thank you for having me again, Stephanie.
Bye.